C3. Number 4, B.
All right. We go to the science chapters. The first one is teaching Christian science. And the scriptural note gives us a key, or a clue, I think you said, clue. It says, give instruction to a wise man, and he will yet be wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. Teaching Christian science apparently hasn't to do with teaching a lot of dumbbells. This teaching the ignorant how to be intelligent, how to understand. It is teaching the wise man, and teaching the wise man, he becomes even wiser. So, in teaching, we have to see that we don't let in any dualism in our thought. The dualism which would consist of having a teacher who knows something and a student who doesn't know the first thing. A lecturer who knows things and an audience who just doesn't know the first things about God. That's the dualism. The dualism is to try to make out of a non-scientist a scientist. We can't do that. We can't make light out of darkness. And so we can't make out of a non-scientist a scientist. You know, the founder of science, the Greek, who lived in the 7th century B.C., whose name was, now don't take me by the word, in English, I think it's called Thales of Miletus. He had a topic for his teaching, and he's considered as the founder of science. He has as a topic, only like can understand like. That's the one. Only like can understand like, only like can instruct like. That teach a wise man, and he will yet be wiser. That's the oneness here. So that we see that a scientist, a Christian scientist, is not 90% ignorant and perhaps a few percent wise, but he is a completely integrated whole, I would say. The text always points out that science is something which cannot be in parts. We cannot practice truth in part. We cannot divide our loyalties. We cannot pursue other vocations. See, there is no split mentality. You call it schizophrenia. There is that. Yes. So there is only, and a scientist is an integrated whole of understanding. And therefore, when we really have to do with teaching, we do that, what Mrs. Eddy says here in this chapter, we advance from the rudiments laid down. But the rudiments are always right. They are not partial. They are not just, they are whole. They are foundational. So that the teaching is always teaching already from the basis and the rudiments of the whole science, so that only science can foster science. That's only, or was it Johnny that said the other day, that only Christian science makes a Christian scientist. Something like that. I was quite sure. Yes. But that was that tone in this chapter. That we can't make out of a non-Christian scientist a scientist. So the attitude which we take in teaching is really the attitude that we know that everyone has the mind of Christ. that everyone really is full of the mind of Christ, and that what we call teaching is really nothing else but mind speaking to mind, spirit touching spirit, soul blessing soul, principle uniting with principle, really life renewing life, truth coming conscious contact with truth, and love really fostering love. So this chapter tells us, when we look at it from the standpoint of oneness, that when we give a lecture, give a talk, give a class, there is always only one mind of Christ, the Christ mind present, and only that can interpret itself to itself, as itself, and for itself. You see, therefore, I think that's why that paragraph on obstetrics appears in this chapter of teaching. Because I feel, I can always be contradicted and I may change my view, that paragraph is mainly concerned with giving birth to science. That paragraph which shows how to give birth to the idea is meant that the idea is nothing else but the Christ science, the idea of Christ science. Naturally, it can be applied to any idea, to give birth to any idea, but its main purpose really is how, and that's our life story really, how to give birth to the scientist in us. How to see that the whole Christ science, which is really our true manhood, how that is being brought to birth. So that paragraph I use mainly and practically foremostly only since years and years to see that the whole science of being, that which I know and especially that which I don't know yet, is really my being. It isn't something that is outside and has to be revealed from outside to me, but revelation is. The God of revelation is within me, that we have seen in the chapter on science and theology and medicine. And here we see that marvelous thing, that the whole structure of the science of being is my being. And I only have to bring it forth to me. And I can bring forth when I really pray rightly and properly and deeply and earnestly and consistently on that paragraph on obstetrics. And then I see that I am the revelation already of the whole idea of science, Christ science. Then I see that I am the development of the idea of Christ science. Then I see that I am the very identification in infinite ways of the idea of the Christ science. And so you can go through the synonyms. I can't go on. I will never stop about that. But you see that we have not somehow to get hold of the idea of Christ science that is somewhere in the air or somewhere ephemeral or anything. It's us. It's already us. It only has to be brought to consciousness. So, though that paragraph can be used for childbirth, though it can be used, say, to bring forth our the solution of some problems which we are facing, face to it, but the pith, I would say, of that paragraph, because it is embedded in the chapter on teaching, is there to see that I give first to my idea of Christ's science. My is with capital M, because there is only one idea of Christ's science. And if we have that love and that nearness of it, that idea of Christ's science must, not because of us, but because of its own value, must appear. It must appear because it is conceived and born of truth and love. It is conceived and born of the perfect form embedded in love. And it comes out through the order of spirit. Then the child is born of spirit. It's through the ordered unfoldment of spirit that little by little comes up. That's perhaps why it was interesting to see the historical review of Mr. Dorlit, because it showed the moment he has touched science, it didn't stop anymore. Every year a new step, unfolding step of what? Of the idea of Christ science came forth. Didn't stop anymore. It doesn't stop anymore with any one of us who have touched it. We can't stop it anymore. Recapitulation. We come to recapitulation. Having seen, you see, that in teaching, man is an integrated whole, that he isn't a little bit of understanding and a lot of ignorance, but is an integrated scientific whole, we now come to recapitulation, which in early time was called the science of man. Recapitulation means a concise summary of principal points, facts, or the like. A summing up. A summing up. And the scriptural note shows that summing up. That summing up of all ideas into one united, integrated whole. For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept. You just hear how one idea and the next idea are summed up, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, there a little, and you take that all in as a summing up. This is the science of man, the compound idea, as the result of this summing up. But she says in the introductory paragraph to that chapter, she says, absolute Christian science pervades its statements to elucidate scientific metaphysics. Now, you have the two. Now, in recapitulation, we see the wedding now of scientific metaphysics to absolute Christian science. Absolute Christian science is that which interprets the principle, and when understood, as Mr. Dorley says, all true relationships between principle and its idea can be determined and demonstrated. That's absolute Christian science. Absolute Christian science is there where we understand divine principle and its relationship to the idea and the ideas with the ideas. So that absolute Christian science pervades, it spreads through, is diffused through the whole extent of, that pervades, scientific metaphysics. In other words, the duality is solved, that duality which says there is metaphysics and there is science. And we have seen that that is a duality which has to be solved, because so many of the Christian sciences in general are just metaphysicians. They are just, what John Dawley says, seeing the relationship of ideas to principle, the relationship of ideas to human beliefs, or they are just trying to take any situation that comes along, any material problem that comes along, and instead of putting it aside, as the chapter on philosophy of physiology says, takes them and says, oh yes, you are, and I lift you above physics and try to see the idea. That's metaphysics. Here, Mrs. Eddy weds this compound metaphysics to science and says, I let absolute Christian science come down and let pervade and spread through the whole extent of metaphysics. So that from now on, really, we reason from God, from the absolute standpoint of God, and let principle's interpretation of itself spread through metaphysics. And in this chapter, therefore, we have quite a lot of this combination of of science and of metaphysics. You see, she starts that whole chapter on recapitulation is one big deduction, so to say, from the absolute standpoint, from God. She starts, what is God? Deduces from God the seven synonymous terms, goes further on and says they refer to one God, they express now the nature and wholeness of deity, there is now no other God besides him. Principle and idea is one, and this one is God. It goes on and says, and his reflection is man, and the varied manifestation of this God now have one principle, cannot be rendered in the plural. See, it comes always further down, cannot be rendered in the plural. All men, now she takes in men, all men have that one mind. So that reasoning is always from mind, and goes on and on through the whole text as one enormous reasoning from God, from absolute Christian science, into the whole field of scientific metaphysics. So as to embed, I would say, scientific metaphysics within the one absolute science. For example, a statement of metaphysics would be, in the scientific statement of being, there is no life, truth, intelligence, no substance in matter. That's a metaphysical statement. It has, standing by itself, it has no science in itself, because it has no deduction from the one being. Therefore, right afterwards, she comes and says, all is infinite mind, and it's infinite manifestation. Now, that's science, and from that standpoint on, I can understand the scientific exactness or truth of the metaphysical statement that there is no life, truth, intelligence in matter. But you can have a metaphysical statement like this, that there is no life, truth, and intelligence in matter in any metaphysical group in this country who hasn't the faintest ideas about science, because it is just stating something about matter, about physics. But its authority is in science, namely in God. All is mind, and it's infinite manifestation. Well, if all is mind and it's infinite manifestation, then naturally there can be no idea in matter. There can be no life, truth, and substance in matter. Can you see the correlation that exists here? And so it goes right on. Oh, well, Genesis. Genesis, I think the duality which is hinted here is that there is a duality of creator and creation. of cause and effect. In prose work, somewhere Mrs. Eddy says that mind is its own cause and effect. There is no duality of cause and effect. You see, that's wonderful in the 7 days of creation, because the same God who says, let there be, he also does it and fulfills it. There is no break between the creator and creation, the cause and effect. So its oneness really lies that God expresses himself within himself. If he would express himself outside of himself, we would have a cause and somewhere an effect. So the effect is always within the cause. That's why we can take the end for the beginning and the beginning leading to the end, just the way around with, because it's all in one. Mr. Dolly said this, he said, the one infinite including within itself everything that is true. It is not God and is italicized. It is not God and man. It is just the one infinite. And that which we call God forever includes within itself that which we call man. For in him we live and move and have our being. See, so man is included in God. If we go home, and just have that sense that God includes the term man, therefore that which I call man is really God, from the point of view of expression, from the point of view of reflection, that therefore when I see man, I see the face of God. When I think of me, I think of me as the face of God, as the operation of God, as the fulfillment of God. Oh, it makes such a difference. She makes here that typical statement which is unique in the whole textbook, where she says spiritual creation is the outgrowth, the emanation of his infinite self-containment. It's a paradox. Taken literally, paradox. Spiritually taken, it gives the pith of that whole chapter. Namely, that which seems to be an emanation or a creation is always a self-containment of the creator. So that cause is in that effect is embedded in cause. There are not two. There is one. Cause and effect is one. Creator and creation is one. God and man is one. So, this is a nice part that we see really in this first part of creation, that what I would call, see, I said in the chapter on teaching, there is shown that man is an integrated whole, is not split up. In the chapter on recapitulation, she calls that man the conscious identity of being. What conscious identity of being? And here, I think, when I was praying over this thing, I suddenly saw what is shown here is that man is integrated into the one being. That we can see that really the conscious identity called man is that which is included in God and therefore integrated into the plan of God, which shows that our whole life purpose is really what is shown here, namely that our whole integrated being will be consciously integrated into the one being. That is our life aim and life goal. So that we don't have that duality of a God and of man who says, I'm working out the plan of God. I'm not working out the plan of God. The plan of God is me. I'm not separated from the plan of God. I am the working of the plan of God. So that I see that my whole future, my whole being, is nothing else than an infinite integration into the self-containment of the plane of being. Naturally, the Adam story, which follows afterwards, just shows the disintegration of old Adam, in order to show that the more I am aware of the integration of being, small b, into being, capital B, the more I see that, and that becomes a oneness, the more the old Adam disintegrates. I also wonder what you think about the following. It has taught me quite some good lessons, and I have tried it out in practice. Namely, I felt that Genesis is a higher method of Christian Science practice than the chapter on Christian Science practice. Don't take me up on it, but let me just put that forward. Because in the chapter on Christian Science practice, which is Christianity as Science, the main point is the demonstration of mind over matter, or what she would call, and which always hit me, to prove by mental means a return to that standard which mortal mind has decided upon as essential for health. So Christian Science practice chapter has as its aim the restoration, really, of physical harmony to that point upon which mortal mind has decided this is health. Genesis is the higher sense. It is science as Christianity, no more Christianity as science, science as Christianity. And there, what is demonstrated is the image and likeness of God. Therefore, the integration into the one being, not just the restoration of the normality of mortal mind. Or let me take it this way, in Christian Science practice, man is shown as the practitioner, and shown the qualities which the practitioner must have in order to help to correct certain beliefs which made the patient sick. In Genesis, man is a conscious being of the divine being, and what he demonstrates is the wholeness of man, not the normality of mortal mind. What he demonstrates there is to be whole spiritually, to be the man of love's plan, to be that which God wants me to be, and not that which mortal mind has decided should be healthy, but that which the divine plan considers a healthy life plan, a healthy life purpose, a healthy life being, if I may say so. The chapter on Christian Science practice shows how to deal with a specific error which demands a solution. That's all right. So there, the problem is defined right from the beginning. The problem is defined. Here is a sick man. What is the solution? In Genesis, so in in the chapter on Christian Science Practice, the purpose there is you have a specific problem that comes to you and has to be solved so as to restore physical harmony. The practice which we get in Genesis is quite different. The problem as a problem is not set, because we don't know what our individuality is. That's what she says there. There are individual forms we do not know. We do not know what God wants us to do, how God is going to use us, if we have to go to Timbuktu tomorrow or not, if we have to close down this or take up that, if we have to do this or that. We have not a set problem, which I say there is an error and I have to solve it. It's a bigger proposition. It's that big proposition where the practice consists in it. Can I put the man into the plan of God? Into the plan of God. To integrate the whole future of somebody into the plan of God. And this is, in practice, quite a different proposition and has to deal with it very differently. So, you see, in Genesis, metaphysics would be quite inadequate, because metaphysics as such, wouldn't be of any help, because metaphysics says it is above physics, and you start from the physical problem and lift it up to the spiritual. But in Genesis, you are already in the spiritual, but the problem is, I don't know what my individuality is. It's always different. Tomorrow this, tomorrow that, the other day this. What is that which God really wants me to be and to do? And that we can only solve from the point of view of science, from the point of view of the one being who does know. The Father knows. The Son does not know. Only the Father knows. So if I am not deeply rooted spiritually in science, Genesis as my life story has no meaning. And I miss life. All what I can do is to repair the old body, to repair a run-down machine, a run-down body. That's all I can do. But not to have the Genesis, the bringing forth into development and into unfoldment that which God alone knows about me. And that's the adventure of love, to be all in all. Then we come to the last chapter, Apocalypse. And here, the scriptural note says, the time is at hand. It's now. Now, Bill Cox, I can say, now. See, that whole chapter of Apocalypse is now showing now. It's the nowness. And combined with it, what is now? Now is the city of God. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. Now I am the calculus of being. Now the greatness of God as an infinite calculus of being is to be praised in my city, in me. It isn't a city outside, it isn't a city, an abstract city, it isn't a city which I figure out, it is me. My present being is a four-sided calculus of being. And therefore, the oneness which is shown here is the closest oneness one can't say that, it's a paradox, but you know what I mean, because here it shows the coincidence of God and man as the divine principle and divine idea. Because coincidence is much more than coexistence. Coincidence is to correspond exactly, to occupy the same place in space and the same period in time. It's now. It's not next to each other, like we coexist with the East. It is in the same place at the same time. Time and space are resolved. The infinite is now. And when I was reading this chapter always in regard to the question of oneness, I was just wondering what it is all about. And then I thought, oh, it's really about everything we have seen up to now. Because in this little chapter, all the various beliefs of duality are brought together. So the duality here seems to be all the plurality of the dualities which we have seen in the chapter. It's the duality here of the human and divine, the relative and the absolute, the objective and the subjective, the understanding and demonstration, the ascending and the descending way, the spirit and matter, this resolve, God and man, human misery and the law of love. All those dualities appear in this chapter, one by one. And so one can see, aha, what you want to show here is really the oneness in omni-action. That there is oneness in omni-action. One universe, one book. One universe which just combines all, the divine and the human statement and proof, the God and man, cause and effect, everything which we have been speaking about this afternoon, is just combined into one and shows there is in reality nothing ever going on but principle operating as the idea of principle. That really man is the operation of mind and spirit and soul and principle and life and truth and love in all categories. That man is really nothing else but the operation of the Word, the operation of the Christ, the operation of Christianity and the operation of science. And if one thinks that over when everything is still around us and just ponders that in the quiet of the night and of the evening, and say, golly, what am I? What is the I am? The I as mind, as spirit, as soul, as principle, as life, and truth, and love. The I as the infinite revelation of being. That's my I. It's the I of the Christ. The eye of that which is a savior to the whole world, which is the revelation of all truth. It's the eye of Christianity, really, the demonstration of the individual, the collective, the universal. It's the eye of science. That is what I am, namely the being that is completely integrated into being so that it coincides with being. And you wonder, now, really, what's the difference between principle and idea? It's one. Well, that is the last chapter. And you see what we have, that when we perhaps once view the textbook from this point of view, that then the textbook will be a new book. I would like to read at the end what Mr. Dawley said in this regard. He said, someday we are going to read Science and Health as Mrs. Eddy wrote it. That is, from the standpoint of inspiration, but it may take centuries. When Mrs. Eddy wrote her textbook, she was humble and pure enough to let the spirit of truth use her. Truth just poured into her thought perfectly naturally. See, it's from the standpoint of science. The process of elaboration and embellishment of the infinite theme of science and health may always go on, as Mrs. Eddy herself foresaw. When you and I have worked our way up through studying the details of the divine system, that's metaphysics, we shall eventually think subjectively from the divine standpoint, that's science standpoint. And then we shall appreciate science and health far more definitely and fully. As our thought becomes more and more cultured in the Word, Christ, Christianity, and science, our sense of science and health will come more and more into consonance with the spirit of the book. Then we will have no more difficulty with the letter. And the letter will be spirit. And perhaps at the end, what John Dolly used to say at the end of his life, he so often said to us, remember, people don't matter. Organization doesn't matter. All that matters is the idea. Goodbye.